with the first pick in the 2017 NFL Draft.
This is the Best Player Available podcast.
The Chicago Bears select Mitchell Trubisky. The Kansas City Chiefs select Patrick Mahomes. The Houston Texans select Deshaun Watson.
It's time to go inside the league's look at the 2017 NFL Draft with the people who made the picks. Here's your host, Neil Stratton.
Welcome back to the Best Player Available podcast. My name's Neil Stratton, and I'm the founder of Inside the League. For episode 6, former Giants area scout Mike Murphy is our guest. Mike joined the Giants in July of 2016 and stayed through the 2019 draft. He's also scouted for the Dolphins, Cowboys, and Chiefs. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how you doing today?
It's great to have you, man, and I really appreciate you juggling your schedule and your kid's schedule and everything else to come on and talk some football, buddy.
Well, if you hear any screaming in the background, it's the kids running around. They're obviously COVID going on here. They're not in school today, so they got their homework done early and kind of running around with some other friends. So I apologize if you hear something.
No worries, man. That's cool. We're all just trying to deal with it as we can. Yeah. All right. So this was a somewhat different draft from the ones that I've discussed previously in this series already, because the Giants are coming off a great season, 11-5 in a playoff appearance. Defense played exceptionally well, 5 all pros. Based on that, Mike, did it change the way you approached the draft? I mean, did you feel like you had a situation where you really could take the best player every time it came around to you, or were you still trying to address specific needs?
Well, it kind of goes back to that conversation, the argument of which came first, the chicken or the egg. You know, everybody enters a draft, you know, talking about taking the best available player. But in reality, I believe there's a combination of the best available, but also what fits the team's most dire needs. Mm-hmm. You know, every team comes out and they've got a list of every other team in the NFL, their needs, to try and figure out what players they may pick. A lot of teams go through mock drafts, try to figure out what player will be left, or try different scenarios to see what player may be available at their pick. That's why you see all these mock drafts, having teams pick the players they do. It more comes down to a lot of need. I think going into the 07 draft, the conversation was try and give Eli Manning more weapons on offense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you talk about Evan Engram, a player that was targeted because of where we were picking. It wasn't the highest rated player on our board, but discussion was, you know, it came down to our pick. We had 3 players available. I can't remember the names off the top of my head, but the thought was that his receiving skills, his ability to stretch the field was a big mismatch, and that made it much more intriguing for us at that position.
So is it fair to say you were looking for an offensive weapon, or were you specifically looking for someone that could catch passes from your quarterback?
I think it was more of an offensive weapon. You know, we had the outside guys with Sterling and what's that guy's name up in Cleveland now? So we had some good receivers there, and just didn't have the tight end in there to help with the blocking, and also a guy that could stretch the field vertically. And I think that's just something that was missing in our offense that the coaches were looking for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So let's talk generally about the draft, or maybe even more, maybe better way to say specifically, if you'd had the top pick that year, Mike, who do you take, and who were the players that you had rated highest in the class, maybe the top 5 to 10 guys?
You know, doing an area, you come out, I did the national scouting for a while and with Dallas, and you get to know everybody on the draft board, so you get to have a really good working knowledge of who they all are and what they can do for you. The issue you have as an area scout is you don't get to see all those other players, and when you go into meetings, you may not watch tape on those players. You may not, you know those players intimately as well as you do players from your area. So that's a tough one to say. Obviously you've got the ones that are out there as a Myles Garrett and those types of the world come out of that draft. You knew that they were going to be good players. So I would have to more go into my area of what I thought were players that were going to be good for my area. And I did the West Coast, and okay, Christian McCaffrey for me coming out of Stanford, I thought he would be a really good upgrade for us. He wasn't the biggest kid coming out, but strong, tough, fast. He could catch the ball. He could block. He did, you know, he's one of those jack of all trades, master of none, but a really good football player. And I thought he would be one that would upgrade us. Also, you got Bowles, the offensive tackle out of Utah, in our position. You know, we had the holes of the offensive tackle position. He went a couple of picks before us. He's one from my area, again, that I thought might be somebody could really come in and plug and help us right then. And then there's also the Solomon Thomas out of Stanford. Mm-hmm. He's a player that, for me, I thought would be able to play all three positions along the defensive line, similar to what we had in Philip Merlin in Miami. Mm-hmm. We play him outside the five, move the three in the one position. I thought in the passing situation, move him inside. And, you know, use his strength in there. I didn't think he had the pure speed to come off the edge. Thought he was better pass rusher inside. So those are the guys that kind of stuck out in my mind from my area that would have helped us in the draft at that time.
I gotcha. Okay. Let's talk about Thomas, because I would not say he's a guy that has set the league on fire, especially the way you might want out of a third pick in the draft. Is mm-hmm. The versatility is nice. The versatility really pays off, especially when you have injuries and all those kind of things. But does the versatility trump just being really outstanding at one position rather than good at several positions?
You know, it's all up to the coaches and what they think, what they feel. I remember people talked about trying to get rid of Philip Merlin in Miami. And we had Cameron Wake on one side, Olivier Vernon on the other, and blah, blah, blah. And there were some people were talking about maybe moving him. And I remember our Casey Rogers was adamant about not getting rid of him because he was so versatile. If somebody went down, he could play outside, he could play inside. So he could play three positions as opposed to the other person playing one. Do I think you have outstanding individuals that you stick out there like a Myles Garrett? Yeah, I think those people, they're difference makers. Whereas the other guy fills a role for you, if that makes sense.
Uh-huh. No, I understand. I mean, based on the fact that Thomas has been a versatile piece in a very good defense with the Niners, but hasn't put up those eye-popping totals, would you say correct. Thomas has warranted being selected number three?
I would probably say no. But I think going into that draft and looking at him and going, okay, being in a 4-3 or 3-4 defense, being able to play the outside linebacker position or being able to play a base end spot. For me, it was playing all three positions. I didn't think he was going to be a true difference maker, but I thought he was going to be a really good player. And I think he's finally found his niche. They've got him inside playing. I think it's a three position, the three technique right now, where I think it kind of helps him what his abilities are.
Mm-hmm. Is a three technique a guy that you typically take in the top 10 picks in the draft?
Depending. You look at Aaron Donald. I mean, well, that's what he's playing. I mean, you know, because what happens with them is they get isolated. They can get isolated on the guard. They've got the quickness inside. They're close to the football. And that's Tony Dungy's thing. He wants the quickness and speed close to the football. And that works out. So mm-hmm. depending on what defense you're running, I know Bill Parcells was more, he wanted the speed outside and make everything spill outside. Tony Dungy was more, he wants the speed and quickness inside because they're close to football. So mm-hmm. it all depends what you're running. And if they're a difference maker and they make a difference on your football team, heck yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I understand. Talking about Christian McCaffrey, Mike, I guess if there's one ding, it has been his durability. Was that a concern for you, given the fact that we're looking at a kid that's probably 205 pounds and, you know, really doesn't come off the field? He's a three down back. I mean, is that something that was a negative in your view?
Yes. And I wouldn't, you know, it's how your coaches use your players. And that was a concern coming out because he, when you watch him in college, he really did run physical for a kid his size. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at 200 pounds and said, how long can those guys handle that pounding? And we had Marion Barber in Dallas, and he went from when Bill Parcells had a conversation with him about you got to decide what kind of back you want to be. And that's when he became the beast. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, it was that body gets broken down. And that's why I think you're looking at different backs. You're looking at combination backs. You're not looking at one guy to tote the rock all the time like you do with Henry in Tennessee. They just don't last.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I understand. You're right. Let's talk about another player that came out of your area. John Ross went number 9 to the Bengals out of Washington. Elite speed. Maybe so much so that he might even be considered a one-trick pony. What were your thoughts on him?
I thought the kid was going to be a really good NFL football player, and I think a lot of other people did as well. You know, he had, like you said, elite speed. That's a scary thing. Take it off, you know, take the top off of things. I remember Gunther Cunningham, you know, he always talked about Jet and Oakland. You know, that was a thing. It just stretched the field. It changes things for your defense and your offense. If somebody can take the top off and then catch the ball, and it changes what you do in the back end and helps your running game out. And I guess, you know, he hasn't obviously lived up to the hype.
Mm-hmm. How, Mike, how do you measure out the things that can't be taught, like elite speed, like elite size, like anything along those lines, against maybe the lack of consistent playmaking in college? I mean, Ross, I think, didn't develop until late. How do you, I mean, I know it's all projection, but yeah. Where do you come down on that, Mike? I mean, when do you feel safe saying, okay, listen, this guy's got such great speed, we have to roll the dice on him, because if he comes through, he's a real difference maker. I mean, on the other hand, obviously it could go the other way. I mean, how do you measure that out?
There was in scouting, like anything else, coaching, you always want to keep learning. You never, if you say you know everything, then there's a problem. I remember going and watching a player out of Ole Miss, a receiver, and he loved his speed. He just, you know, was more of a 50-50, but he was a straight line runner. And so I put him down maybe in the 5th round or something like that. And then I went to I watched him in the beginning of the year. So I didn't see him later in the year, but then I went to the pro day, and you watched him, and Steelers coach was there working with him, and you watched him teach him how to run routes. And it's a lot of things you don't get in college. It's more of, we're running as many plays as we can to get it. And there's not a lot of teaching going on in how to run routes, how to set people up. And we went to that pro day, and I watched that coach with him teach him how to run routes, how to set people up, sink the weight, come out of breaks, gain that separation. And I looked at my, said to myself, oh, crap, I missed on this one. Called the offense, said I'm way too low on this kid. Anyway, Pittsburgh drafted him, I think, in the 3rd round, and he had a pretty good career. And I think that's what's happening with the other the New York Giants drafted the kid out of Ole Miss again a couple years ago. And I watched him on tape, and it was the same type of feeling. You could teach this kid, you could watch him, he could teach him how to run routes.
It's as someone who's not a scout and not a coach, obviously, it's remarkable to think that a kid could come out of the SEC where the competition is so high and the bar is so high and there's no shortage of coaches, and he wouldn't have gotten that kind of coaching. Mike, is that an unusual thing?
You got to look at the time that the kids are allowed to work with your coaches. You know, you got the 20-hour rule, and so you got to have meeting time and field time, and then they also take into consideration game day. So they don't get the all year, you know, all year round, you know, going into the office at 6:30 in the morning and not leaving until close to dinner time. So you don't get that individual work with those kids. And then, you know, your offenses are different in college. A lot of the spread stuff. You know, you go to the air raid, and that's a lot of simple routes, and you know, you're not really trying to set people up and not trying to run a lot of different routes. Mm-hmm. So them being taught those things is different.
Mm-hmm. Does it concern you at all that a player may not be coachable when he comes to you in the NFL and he doesn't know those basic route concepts, those basic ways of how to get open, get separation, all those kind of things?
You know, I think that's part of the reason why your scouts go do everything. They watch, you know, they watch the game tape, they watch practice. You talk to everybody you can on and off the field. And that's where we're getting your relationships at the schools and talking to the coaches, talking to the trainers, the strength coaches, et cetera, and how those kids love the game or they don't love the game. So it's on and off the field. You're scouting those kids, not just what they can do on the field, but what they do off the field. Can they learn? Will they work at their craft? Do they love the game? So when you try and figure that out, once you figure it out, you go to the pro day and you're like, okay, I want you to run this, or this is where I want you to break. This is what I want you to do. And like I said, going back to the Pittsburgh coach working, now you see it. You see those guys being able to do it. Can they take it? And I have a friend of mine that was working for the Yankees, and his comment to me, he was a hitting coach in the major leagues for a long time. He says, Mike, the good ones, you tell them once and they get it. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're trying to look for, those guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A bit off topic, Mike, but I think you're probably as qualified to answer this question as anyone. You've been with a lot of teams. You have numerous friends in the game. Coming off of a year that has been so unlike any others, do you feel like teams are going to miss because they didn't pick up in Zoom what they would have picked up going into the office and talking to the strength coach or having coffee with the academic advisor or anything like that? Or do you feel like most of that stuff will be still pretty seamless, that they were able to get the things that they needed to get without actually being on the ground?
I think the younger scouts might have some issues, might have more problems than the others. Because when you go to schools, you start making those relationships. And once you make those relationships, you'd be able to call somebody, outside the Zoom and say, hey, what about this? And they might tell you something different that they didn't tell you in the Zoom call. So I think the younger ones might have a little more issue. The older ones that have those, they've been around, been in their area and have those relationships built up with the schools, with the coaches, whoever it may be, they might give you something a little different than a company line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's the sense that I get as well. We really won't know for 3 or 4 years how this year affected the draft, but it'll be really fascinating to watch and see if we can put our finger on certain ways that the draft moved because of that, vacancy, I guess you'd say.
Absolutely. Not being able to see players in person, what they do on the sideline, how they react, if they're a team guy, if they're a me guy, I remember Parcells always said, don't bring me the guys with the issues off the field. I got enough problems trying to teach them and do the other things on the field. So, just trying to see how the people react, how the players react within teammates, whether they're losing, whether they're winning, et cetera. So that makes a big difference.
Yeah, no question about it. All right, Mike. Speaking as a scout, as a seasoned guy, as a veteran guy, is there a sense of disappointment when you draft in the last third of the round? I mean, obviously it's good that you've won, you've been placed back here, but it kind of puts you away from the impact players. Am I wrong? And does it limit what you do?
I don't think it's a case of disappointment drafting lower. If that were the case, like you mentioned, you wouldn't be coming off a good season the year before. So coming out of the 16th season, I thought, a lot of us thought we were on the verge of making a run at the whole thing and went into training camp and early in training camp before the 2017 season, the pads came on. We really thought we had a chance of winning it all. So, answer your question, you always want the best players in the draft, but if you do the work, you do your due diligence, then you feel like you've drafted the best player available at that position. So I think you're looking for players to fill a role and you feel like you've got your nucleus already set. And where can I fill in somewhere in here to fit that, to help us?
Mm-hmm. We've spoken to a lot of scouts in this series and they all have varying levels of participation on draft weekend. Where were the Giants in that spectrum? Did they keep y'all in the room with everyone? Did you have free access to the board? Was there a lot of transparency or was it a bit of, okay, the hay's in the barn, you guys are done. Y'all can kind of take a back seat while the big, big boys make the picks.
Yeah. Sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but we were in the draft room. Everybody was in there. We were part of it. And that was the feeling was, hey, this is all your work that you guys have done once you're part of it. And, they made us feel a part of it. And they asked the questions. When it came down to our pick, you had three players sitting there and you gave your spiel about those players. I remember Mike Holmgren was the same way. And when I was in Seattle, and get up there and say, okay, here's the three players. Tell me about them. Mm-hmm. And so you have your spiel about them. And then he'd make his decision on who they were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like Jerry Reese was a scout kind of GM or was he a guy that kind of took a consensus and worked the coaches in as well? I mean, did you feel like he was listening to you?
Yes. Yeah. I think he's listening to us. You also got to take into consideration, they're coaching him and if you run into a situation where the coach doesn't want him at all and you pick him, they're not going to play him. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, the coaches might not be there very long if that's the case on a consistent basis, but you know, you have to be able to come to some kind of an agreement where, okay, they're not going to coach this guy, so let's not bother taking him for one reason or another. So, mm-hmm. yes, there is a – he was a scouts GM, but he also very much took into consideration the coaches.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, again, because y'all picked later in the round, you had to watch a lot of players go that you might have been interested in. Were there any players that year that you're poised to take and they went immediately before y'all picked?
I don't think there was, thinking back on it, I don't know if there was anybody in particular that we were targeting. I think because of where we were, like I said, going back to how every team is sitting there thinking, okay, who's taking what player? So you're doing your must needs and wants for each team. And so, you know, they need a defensive end. This guy's going here. This guy needs an offensive tackle, so he's going there. So I don't, you're kind of hoping that somebody drops to you. Similar to, you know, Aaron Rodgers dropping the 23rd pick in the draft. Nobody would ever thought that ends up in mm-hmm. Green Bay.
Right.
So you're hoping that somebody drops to you, but in reality, you kind of have an idea of what players are going to be there when you pick. And that's where it came down to us with the first pick. You know, it was three players with Engram being one of them. And you had your discussion on who was going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now you discussed earlier, Mike, that y'all did your own mock drafts to kind of maybe yeah. see how the pieces were going to fit and how the dominoes were going to fall. What did that look like? Did Jerry come in and say, okay, you're this team, you're this team, you're this team? Or was it just kind of a general consensus? Okay, we think this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. You kind of did it all together.
No, it's you take those mock drafts that I talked about. You know, everybody's got their own mock draft out there. I think it was Goslin that had his top 100 out of Dallas. He was kind of somehow tapped into the league, had a good idea who the top 100 players are going to go off the board. But mm-hmm. you went and had different mock drafts you used. And then you also had a must, needs, and wants list from every team in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And so I would have, maybe I've got Arizona and Seattle and somebody else has got Philadelphia and Baltimore or something like that. So all of the scouts had different teams. Mm-hmm. And you just went down the draft and you just did a mock draft. Okay, you're up first. Cleveland, you're taking Myles Garrett. And you just go down the board and you pick it that way and kind of see who's available. And then it would be one of those things, well, okay, let's change it up. I want you to trade because this might happen. I want you to trade to this one, you to trade to that one, and then take your picks. Mm-hmm. And just to kind of see, change things up to see, you know, what's going to fall, what might show up to you. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things where Evan Engram shows up three times when you do the mock drafts. You're okay. picking the three times. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get an idea who's going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, Rick Goslin didn't have the hair of Mel Kiper Jr. And maybe not.
nobody does.
Maybe not the youth of Todd McShay or, you know, a number of other people. But I think he's always been a really unsung person in this whole process and so widely respected. Yet your rank and file fan may not know who he is, especially the no. younger generation. But so it's interesting yeah. to hear you talk about how he was, to some degree, part of your draft prep.
He was a big part of our draft process, especially in Seattle. That was one that was they used out there with Tim when he came in. You know, so that was the one that he put up there. He would follow through and who the top 100 guys were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, let's take a let's talk about a guy that I think you had a little bit of investment in, maybe did a little table jumping on, was California quarterback Davis Webb. There were a lot of interesting quarterbacks taken in this draft, obviously. We've talked at length about that, about those quarterbacks in this series. You had a two-time Super Bowl winner already taking snaps for you, and yet you went and used a top 100 pick on Davis Webb. Take me through the decision-making process there. And how he kind of came to be that guy for you?
I think part of it was the unknown, what was behind Eli, knowing where Eli was in his career. So you're trying to figure out what to do. When I went out to college and watched him, you kind of watched him play out there, and it was like playing sandlot football. The footwork wasn't great. The arm The technique wasn't great, but man, it was a whip. He had a great arm to him. He had quick feet. He'd get the feet around, get his hips around, get the ball out quickly. And so you kind of watched all that stuff and the leadership you talk about on the field, off the field, the teammates love him. He's in the office all the time watching tape. He's helping the coaches put the game plan together. But then it also comes back down to what the offense was that he was playing in. And so that's kind of where you went. That was a ding to start with. But the air raid just doesn't seem to transfer over to the NFL. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big question. He slowly climbed up the board, and the guys that went in front of him, I think rightfully so, were better suited right out of college to play and ready to go. I thought with Davis Webb, with all of his talents, all of his ability, I think he would be able to be a solid number two with the chance to, you know, possibly progress into a number one. Mm-hmm. Obviously that didn't happen. I think, you know, I wasn't around him all the time, but I think some of it came, you know, paralysis by analysis. Very smart individual, but just couldn't let the ball go when it came time to. I think that was part of the problem.
Hmm. Interesting. You alluded to the air raid aspect of things. And as I've spoken to scouts and executives so far through this series, that's one of the major dings that came up on, you know, how Patrick Mahomes winds up, you know, sliding, quote unquote, to, you know, the 10th pick in the draft. How do you sift out the system versus the prospect? I mean, obviously, you know, Aaron Rodgers, as you alluded to earlier, is a guy that slid into 23 because there hadn't been any successes coming out of Cal. And yet, wow, you know, what a career he's had. Same for Patrick Mahomes. Yeah. How do you go in and say, okay, this is a guy that succeeded and could succeed in almost in the NFL as well as this maybe gimmicky kind of offense?
That gets back into, I think, a lot of your relationships you have in college with the coaches. I remember coming out of Florida State, and I knew a coach on the staff, and Buffalo had drafted a quarterback up there. But I, you know, was adamant about his ability to be able to transfer what he did at Florida State to the next level, because everything was predetermined where he was going. It was told where he was going, what he was going to do. Hmm. And so now you have second thoughts about, can this guy actually see it, process it, and get the ball out quickly? And so that's part of the problem I have with the air raid that you see, is a lot of it's predetermined where they're going to go pre-snap. So they know that the head fakes holding the safety, this or that, it's not the true thing of holding a safety or making those reads and getting the ball out on time. Mm-hmm. That answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. That's an interesting aspect of it. It's that, you know, again, that's just kind of what has come up consistently. And especially as it relates to Patrick Mahomes, he seemed to be such a unique talent and had brought a lot more to the table than a Kingsbury or a Seth Doege or Baker Mayfield, you know. He was not your classic air raid kind of guy. And yet, you know, he fell to 10 and a lot of good people passed on him. And it's obviously easy to sit here and say, wow, how could they do that? But there were a lot of well-founded questions and concerns. And I guess that's true of a lot of prospects every year.
And that's who beat out Davis Webb. You know, Davis transferred. I was at Colorado. We were trying to recruit Davis out to Colorado. And he sat in on meetings and they talked about how smart he was, how they could read defenses, talk through everything. So that's kind of where I felt more comfortable with him, being able to transfer that game to the NFL. Yes, I missed on that one.
Interesting. I didn't think about that part of the story that you had been at Colorado prior to your time in New York, and so you kind of had that working relationship with him to some degree as well. That's really interesting. Okay. All right. So the season was very successful, but it was kind of in spite of a rather weak rushing attack. Rashad Jennings led the team with less than 600 yards, and he only had 3.3 yards per carry. The 17 draft, as we know now, was really deep at running backs, has had seven running rushers who've made it to at least one Pro Bowl, and yet y'all waited until the fourth round to draft Clemson's Wayne Gallman. Did you feel like Jennings' best years were still ahead of him? Did you feel like running back was not a priority in your offense? Were there other reasons why maybe y'all shied away from stocking up that position?
I think a lot of it came with Paul Perkins. You know, he came on at the end of the year, and I think with Darkwar and Ben Perkins, I think the thought process was the combination working those guys in, we could be successful and have a good running attack. Obviously, you know, you'd love to have Alvin Kamaras or the Kareem Hunts, but again, Kareem went right before us. But you're looking at people what they do on and off the field, so. As things fell, you know, the running back position, it wasn't one at that time, the 23rd pick, that you thought, okay, this is worth it. We thought the tight end would probably be more productive for us. And then as you get into the second round, you know, how D linemen are coveted, you know, it's a coveted commodity on all levels. So, you know, Thomason was sitting there as a D lineman and needed run stuffing D tackle, young kid that could be a true nose for us. So that's kind of where you're looking. Mm-hmm. You know, as you drop down into the third round, and we only had six picks that year, but you drop into the third round, you said, okay, Geno Smith was unsure of what his future with us was going to be, whether he was going to be with Eli or not. And so that's when you ended up taking Davis Webb in the third pick. And so now you're sitting there with the fourth pick and, you know, Gallman was sitting there, and there was a lot of love for him at Clemson from the guys that went through Clemson, and, you know, ended up being a solid player of what we thought he would be, a solid number two.
Mm-hmm. You're right. He has been a solid player for you, especially at 140 in the draft. But it's a little interesting that the three players chosen before him were all out of your area. Do you recall Utah's Joe Williams? Do you recall San Diego State's Donnell Pumphrey? Do you recall BYU's Jamal Williams and what you thought about those guys?
Yes. Pumphrey's issue with him was overall size. You kind of liked what he did, but it was what 180 pounds, I think was what he was, something like that. He wasn't a big kid, but he was dynamic, but it was still, what are you going to do with him? He's really a third. I thought he was going to be more of a third down back, mm-hmm. you know, come out of the backfield, play on special teams, return kicks and that sort of stuff. But, mm-hmm. you know, 180 pounds, you talked about McCaffrey earlier. You know, taking the pounding he's taken at 200 pounds, a bigger kid, much bigger kid, and he's had injury issues. So mm-hmm. that was where, you know, drop a little bit further in the draft. Love the kid, the Williams kids from BYU. I thought he would be a solid number two for us, rotational guy that could take the pounding. He could be an every down back for you, but, you know, just overall lack of speed, but I thought he'd be a solid player. Mm-hmm. Who was the other one you mentioned?
Joe Williams from Utah went 121 to the Niners.
Joe Williams liked him. I just don't remember exactly. Sorry, off the top of my head, mm-hmm. going back a few years. I think he was another one that we liked. I think the question on him was more of the mental side of things. If I don't quote me on that, mm-hmm. that might be off. So
that's fine. Just a couple more that went in the fifth round. Brian Hill out of Wyoming. Do you recall him at all?
Yes. Yeah. I thought he would be a solid number two backup special teams guy. Tough kid. It just wasn't in the category of the Gallmans.
Sure.
The Wayne Gallmans of the world.
I got you. And then one more that went 5-162, Jeremy McNichols out of Boise State.
Undersized. Good running back, solid again. A good another number two guy for us, just a little bit undersized. Like what he brought to the table for backup special teams guy.
Okay,
but I don't think, you know, because of the size, I just don't. You're looking at those guys and saying, okay, can they be an every down back? And then you covet those people more, or you're looking at more of a rotational guy, and you kind of their value drops a little bit more.
Sure. Yeah. No doubt. Yeah, well, size is always a factor when you're taking the kind of punishment the running backs take, obviously. Okay, so, Mike, the team had spent quite a bit of draft capital in 2016 at cornerback when they took Ohio State to Eli Apple. And that year, Janoris Jenkins had a tremendous game. He was really at the top of his game, a tremendous season. Top of his game, lots of big plays, had really fulfilled the promise that he had coming out of college. Given all this, how much work did you do on cornerbacks for the 17 draft? And were there any that the team really liked?
You know, going into preparing for your draft, you try and evaluate every player as if they're going to, you know, you're going to draft them. That's what we mentioned, Aaron Rodgers falling to you. You know, you're kind of going, I was in Kansas City and we had, I'm drawing a blank here, Randy Moss. You know, we just thought he would go long before he got to us. I think we were drafting 21 and he went 18 or something like that, or by he was 15, we were 18. But you want to do your due diligence on everybody just in case something like that happens. You never know what's going to be staring you in the face. So Eli, you know, he did struggle a little bit, but nobody's going to give up on the kid. You know, they drafted him high. I think it was the 10th pick in the draft. Mm-hmm. He still had some growing up to do, but you saw the flashes. Were there other kids we coveted? you want to do Lattimore? He would have been nice. Remember, there's another one out of USC.
Adoree Jackson.
Tennessee right now. Yeah.
Adoree Jackson.
You know, his thing was, yep, his thing is also returnability. So, you know, you're looking, he's got more than just cover skills, but he's also a return guy as well. And then I worked at Colorado. Knowing from my area, or at least knowing the kids from my area, it was Chido Owuze. Mm-hmm. And he's with Dallas, and he was a kid that we had played at safety, corner, slot. You know, he had all he had smarts, he was tough, he was versatile, and he was a guy that I thought, you know, we could use. And then there were other kids, you know, like Kevin King and Sidney Jones out of Washington. They had really good length and speed. I just don't think that the cornerback at the time, there was really something high on our list that we were looking for because of who they drafted before, mm-hmm. and the way the guys had played and our depth there.
What'd you think about Akella Witherspoon, another kid that came out of Colorado?
Talented. All the physical skills to be a really good player in the NFL. It was just there was a lot of growing up we had to do mentally, knowing him very well. So I'll kind of leave it at that.
I get it. Now, you mentioned Adoree Jackson out of USC. He was the 18th pick in the draft of the Titans. You mentioned the return ability. When you're drafting at 18, are you willing to take maybe a B cornerback that's got special teams ability, or do you really want an A cornerback at 18, and then anything you get beyond that is gravy?
I had this conversation with Paul Hackett when I was with the Chiefs, and we were talking about building our team, and he got to take the first pick, so he took a quarterback. The next pick I took was a corner, or a pass rusher, I think it was. Can't remember if it was either a pass rusher or a corner, so we went back and forth. And so me and everybody else that I know would take a corner. That's what he has to do first. Mm-hmm. Has to be able to cover guys.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. Okay. All right, so there were 7 defensive ends taken in the first round that year, but the Giants had really exceptional depth on the defensive line across the line, I mean, end to end. Given the level of depth y'all had, the level of depth at an impact position in that draft, despite the fact that you had so many playmakers, did y'all consider taking a pass rusher? And were there any defensive ends that you liked maybe more than others?
Yeah, we'd already talked about Solomon Thomas, you know, going 3. He was one that I liked because of the versatility going back, you know, like Philip Merling. I thought he'd be a starter for us. Pass rushing wise, you know, obviously you've got JPP and Olivier Vernon. There wasn't a big discussion on pass rushers because of those guys we had out there. We had depth at that position. So I think when Tomlinson was sitting there in the second pick of the draft or second round of the draft for us, that was the one we looked at. And then also looking at the board, the third pick in the draft for us, in the third round, it was, okay, what else is available? Where is our quarterback situation? So, you know, you ended up, I think, drafting a little bit for need. Mm-hmm. He only had 6 picks in the draft, so now you're drafting a little further down. You got the running back, and then now you're looking for, okay, what are we looking for? What do we want? You're looking for guys that you think can develop into something and play on special teams while they develop. And so I think that's where we ended up with Avery Moss, mm-hmm. because of his athletic ability, you know, ability to contribute early on special teams and not sit on the bench. And that's the thing, if you're drafting down there or you're playing and you're not starting, you have to be able to play on special teams. And so, like I said, again, that was the Avery Moss pick, I think, is kind of the conversation piece.
I get you. Now, there were 2 defensive linemen that went top 100 out of your area, both out of UCLA. Do you recall Tock McKinley? Was he a guy that you kind of liked? And do you feel like he went where he belonged at 26? And then Eddie Vanderdoes, he went to the Raiders as a defensive tackle, who went, 88. Is that right? 88. Were those guys that you felt kind of went where you thought they'd go?
McKinley, I really liked coming out. I thought, you know, being a 3-4, 4-3, I thought he could be versatile, be able to do either one, depending on what we were playing. Vanderdoes, liked him. Thought he was going to be somewhat limited to, I think, overall speed of his play, but did like him as well.
Okay. Now, McKinley was a bit of a one-year wonder, Mike. Yeah. Was that a concern for you?
It always is. You know, it's like, why? That's the question you're always trying to answer. Why is it that it took him this long to play? Why did it always take him? So you're always asking those questions, what happened beforehand? What happened beforehand? You know, Darnold coming out of USC the year before he got drafted, he played lights out, and he comes back the next year. What happened? Well, his offensive line was gone. He had new young receivers over there playing, so he was scrambled for his life. Guys weren't running the right routes, right depth, and everything else. So you're kind of looking at that. You're looking at reasons why people didn't play early or didn't play well later on. They played better the year before.
Getting a bit off topic, is Darnold a kid that you got a good look at in your, you know, role as a West Coast scout?
Yes. I thought the kid would be, I liked the three kids that came out of there. Physically, they had all the tools to come out and do it. I thought Darnold would be further ahead than he is now. Go into whatever's going on with New York. I can't answer that question, what's going on up there. So, but I really did like him. I thought he had all the tangibles to be a really solid player in the NFL.
In your opinion, Mike, if he goes somewhere else, can he still be the player that you thought he would be?
From what I saw in college, yes, I think so. You know, you look at Ryan Tannehill, we drafted, I think it was 8th pick in Miami. And things didn't quite work out well there. And he goes to Tennessee, and, you know, they've got an offense running around Henry over there, and it really helps out what he can do best. So I think, you know, put some weapons around Darnold, and maybe, you know, sometimes different scenery is helpful for some of those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Darnold's. He's, even though some of these quarterback questions are being answered, he's still certainly a player to watch as we move forward. And it'll be interesting to see if he is still in the Jets roster when we start the season here in September.
Yep.
The team had chosen Miami offensive tackle Eric Flowers with the 9th pick in 2015, but his first two seasons were not his best two seasons, and he really kind of struggled. Was there any thought given to taking, you know, you mentioned Utah's Garrett Bowles. Was there a thought to taking him? Was there a thought to taking maybe Wisconsin's Ryan Ramczyk or any of the other high-rated tackles, given that you had spent such so much draft capital so recently on that position?
You know, there was a lot of conversation about taking an offensive tackle. Everybody, you know, when you look at your draft, everybody's got holes in them. You just try not to poke too many holes in them and hurt yourself when you're drafting guys. You know, going back to why somebody didn't play earlier, what happened here, I think Bowles, I think he was coming out, he had limited play time, you know, at a high level. I think he was coming out of junior college. I think that was a concern mentally because of that. I think Ramczyk was one coming out of Wisconsin. I think he had hip issues, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
So I think there was a concern there. So it was, you know, you have your medical people there talking to you as well. You know, what's his lifespan going to be? You know, if he's had this issue or this injury, what is going to happen here? How long is it recover if he's had surgery? So a lot of those questions come up during the draft meetings, and, you know, they might ding him during the draft. And so, yes, they're good players, but, you know, you're looking at Evan Engram and, you know, didn't have any holes to him. Great kid, could run. Biggest thing on him was he wasn't a really big individual. You know, he was really a hybrid H-back. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was those questions and those conversations, yes. But when it came down to, I think Evan was the one with the least holes in him, and the coaches were, you know, they're on board. They wanted him because they gave him an extra weapon on offense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you mentioned injuries, Mike, and you've worked with a number of teams. How do teams, I guess, manage risk when it comes to injuries? And do you feel like it's that all teams kind of are scared in the same way? Or do you find that some teams look at injuries completely different and have a completely different point of view or willingness to kind of roll the dice from other teams? Obviously, there's a spectrum, but, you know.
Yeah, I think things are changing because of the length of the contracts. You don't see those 6-year contracts anymore. You know, it's a 4-year with an option. So I think I know for a fact there's one team that, hey, he's injured, we're going to get 4 years out of him and move on. There's other ones that don't, you know, they don't want to take that risk. They're worried about it. I remember Quinn coming out of North Carolina. I watched him, loved him, thought he would be, you know, what he is, you know, had a really good career. But we wouldn't touch him because of the medical concerns. Hmm. You know, so, you know, it's kind of a, your risk reward, you know, what is the risk and, you know, what's the reward out of that if you take that risk?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think 4 years, 4 good seasons out of a first rounder does warrant being taken the first round?
I think it can be, yeah. And what's your average player right now? I think the right lifespan is, what, 3 years and 4 games or something like that?
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously it's a function of where a player's taken and is he top 10? Is he first 32? Is he day 2, day 3, whatever? There's some factors way into that. But it is interesting that it sounds like what you're saying is that teams are looking at these players – as a bit more disposable maybe than what your normal rank and file draft fan thinks.
Yeah. You know, you want to keep your core together and that's the biggest part is keep your core together. And then you've got other parts you can fill in here and there. And I think when you go back and look at the running back spot, how many running backs come in and out of the league, how fast they roll in and out.
Right.
You know, you're looking at receivers used to be, you know, looked at it a certain way. And I think they've kind of dropped off a little bit. You look at Juju Smith now, he's out of Pittsburgh, and you would think that there's a kid that's got all the talent, he would stay there, but the young guy's coming in and you just keep replacing. So,
right.
As, you know, it's a NFL, what do they say, not for long. So you got to keep producing and you got to get better. You're always trying to get better or the people in charge are getting fired. So,
yeah, that's definitely the truth. All right. Well, let's kind of wrap things up here, Mike, by just, I'm gonna throw you a couple names of guys that were day 3 or UDFA that came out of your area, and maybe give your thoughts on them. Some of them may not be in your area. I don't know. Every team seems to define what's West differently.
yes.
Did you get a chance to evaluate George Kittle out of Iowa at all?
At the time, no, I didn't go in there, but I remember him in the conversation about him with the upside. You know, smart, tough. You know, good upside to him, obviously playing in a pro style offense in Iowa. They liked him up there. And I think what's that saying? You know, thanks for the flash, Gordon. He turned out to be a pretty good player in San Francisco.
Boy, he really has developed into a playmaker.
And
having spoken to a lot of these scouts, not many saw him being the kind of player he's turned out to be. But I think that's also to some degree a function of working with Kyle Shanahan, who's really got a real gift when it comes to making offensive players shine.
You're putting, you know, that's the job of coaches is putting players in position to make them look good, you know, do the things that they do well. And
exactly right.
Kyle seems to have a good feel for that.
Yeah, he's got a knack. BYU quarterback Taysom Hill.
he was a pet cat of mine. He really was. I really liked the kid in college, and he struggled some, but the offensive line, he had some issues over there. He was heavier than he should have been. I think he was sitting around 240.
Oh, wow.
When I went to the pro day, he was down to about 220, and I think he was a poster child for Beachbody. But the kid had all the intangibles. He had arm strength. He had athletic ability, toughness. He's smart. You know, everybody loved him, great personality, all those intangibles. And I remember Dave McLuhan and I went, worked him out at different positions at the pro day. We had him all over the place, a quarterback, running back, wide receiver, DB, and the kid stole the show.
Wow.
You know, kind of one of those jack of all trades. And I thought the kid would be a great special teams player. So a sign stand on the table for him, and he seems to have turned out. I got one right. He's turned out just exactly what I thought the kid would be.
Did y'all take a swing at him in undrafted free agency?
I don't know if we did, to be honest with you. I don't think we did. I can't remember. Honestly, I can't remember.
Was age a concern? I think he was 26 maybe as a rookie.
You know, with the quarterback situation, that's always a concern because, you know, how long are you going to keep him on the bench? You know, how long is he going to play? Now, if, you know, he's sitting behind somebody like an Eli Manning or whoever it may be, you're sitting there for 4 or 5 years. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to be 30. Now what? So, you know, going into those long-term contracts and the four-year contracts, I think the quarterback situation is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Because of that, you know, the way things are with them. If you don't have one, as you see in the NFL, you don't have one, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no question about that. Do you – I don't know, you know, obviously it's been a few years now, but do you recall – do you remember him being the kind of kid that would be malleable, or was he putting his foot in the ground and saying, I'm a quarterback or I'm nothing at all?
No, he was open for anything. That's why I said – we asked him to play a different position. We went through all of the pro day, you know, what they call gymnastics, you know, the running, jumping, and all that sort of stuff. And then we went to the position drills. He did all the drills at quarterback, and then we put him through running back drills and through the bags and all that stuff. And then we put him out at wide receiver running routes. Then we put him at DB, you know, chasing ball. He didn't quit. He loved it. He went and did it all. He didn't complain about it. He asked, what else do you want me to do?
Wow. Interesting. Okay. UTEP running back Aaron Jones.
Yes. I didn't go in there. I remember them talking about him. Tough, had good speed, could catch the ball, block, do all those sort of things. I know they really liked him. I think we had him draftable on the board, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Texas was a Southwest. I mean, you probably had a Southwest guy that covered El Paso that year?
Yeah, because it's kind of one of those, I don't know if we're allowed to say this, but one of those bastard schools that it's kind of in the between nowhere. And so when you're splitting the country up, it's like, okay, you've got X amount of schools and X amount of players in those areas, and you're trying to spread it out to make sure that you're not getting somebody overloaded. And so that one, to go into El Paso, was really a long haul to get in there.
Yeah, El Paso and Albuquerque and Las Cruces, you got it's easy to get overlooked at those schools. Those are tough ones.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, you didn't do Oklahoma State either. My next one on my list is Chris Carson. That's okay. I didn't think you did, but I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah. Again. Yeah. He's turned into a pretty good running back. I remember listening to him talk about him, and you see him on TV, he's a lot bigger than I expected him to be.
Yeah, but for his injury issues, he's been a very productive player, especially for an undrafted free agent. Been a special talent for him.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you so much, man. It's been so much fun talking about the draft with you. You've been a friend for a long time. I've always come through for me, and I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. And it's been a lot of fun. And thanks for answering all these questions and giving so many insights on everything, buddy.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and asking me. Hopefully I got some of these things right. Hopefully I answered some of your questions too. So I enjoyed it. Thanks for asking me.
You've been great on the question. There's a scout, if you're right half the time, then you've got a great batting average, and you far exceeded that today.
Nobody's a virgin in this thing. Everybody's missed something.
You got that right. Remember, if you are interested in the scouting profession, if you're interested in hearing the stories behind the stories, my book is called Scout Speak. You can find it on Amazon. It's out there. I think you'll really enjoy it. We also have a newsletter that comes out every Friday evening called The Friday Wrap, and you can find that on my Twitter account at Inside the League. It goes out to about 5,000 people across the league. We talk about the business of the game there. There's also Succeed in Football, my personal blog, and we typically talk about the highlights of these calls, at least lately, there. And, of course, there's the mothership, InsideTheLeague.com. We've been around for 20 years talking about the part of the game maybe that fans don't get to see as much. Hope you can join us next week. Thanks so much for joining us this week.